This is part three of a series titled The Search for Community. And what I'm going to do today, what I did yesterday, which was refer to some things that are a consequence of conversations that I've been in since yesterday. There were three things that came up. First of all, Julie suggested that I clarify something or maybe rethink something on the question of risk. I said yesterday that I took very low risks in coming to Seattle, and she wanted to point out that my family took much larger risks, which is true. She also pointed out that there are such things as non-financial risks. That's also true. However, as I reflected on this, it occurred to me that the statement that I made, that I took very low risks, was almost a tautology, almost true by definition. Because if a person commits himself to something, he doesn't think there's much risk in it. Is there much risk in climbing Glacier Peak? The person who's headed out to do it won't say so. He'll say, no. No, it's, you know, but that's the thrill of it. But for me, out of the question. So I guess if somebody wants to do something, almost by definition, he doesn't see much risk in it. All right, Sarah Pitcher brought up something about tasks and community. I raised the question of, can you create community directly, or is community sort of a byproduct of people engaged in a common task? And she pointed the question at a parish. And this is an issue that comes up. It came up in her parish, and it's up right now in one of my parishes in Seattle. Should the congregation be about some task, some social task? Should it have some mission to the community? Should the congregation, should all the members of the congregation be involved in Bread for the World? Or there are all kinds of projects, obviously. And I did not want to leave the impression that I thought congregations ought to take on tasks of this sort, because I definitely don't think they should. If the members of a congregation, and it's unlikely that all of them would want to, but if a certain number, a large number, or even the whole number of the members of a congregation individually decide, of course influenced by one another in their congregational life, that they want to go out and tackle some social problem, fine and good. But the idea of the church solving social problems is, I think, dangerous in the extreme. For one thing, you're just not going to have everybody involved, everybody feeling the same way. But when the church does it, then you've got to go along. When the church engages in social action, moves as a body, there's an implication there that to drag your feet is to sin, to set your face against the will of God. And that's dangerous. That lays guilt trips on people. There are no social causes which are not fraught with ambiguity. And right now, in one of our congregations in Seattle, there is a man who is attempting to force the people of this small church to commit themselves to a whole bunch of social tasks that he wants done. And I don't know what's going to happen first, whether he's going to be excommunicated or he's going to withdraw, but he is driving those people crazy, because they happen to be this remarkable thing. Every one of the nuclear members of that congregation is engaged in social action. And when they come to church on Sunday morning, they want to celebrate. They want to strengthen one another. They want to refuel for the tasks out there. They will share with one another what they're doing. The time for community concern. Someone will talk about the task and ask if we could use some help in, say, gathering signatures for the petition, the initiative to get the sales tax off food. But then they want to celebrate. They don't want to be told that God requires them now to raise $15,000 to You say, well then, gee, what is the task of the church? One of the tasks of a congregation, a very important task, I think sufficient task to make it a community, is the task of creating a celebratory occasion each Sunday morning. That's a lot of task. Maybe more effort were just put in on that and less frittered away. But, alright. Alright. Oh, the other thing, did Jack Barnes leave?
Yeah.
Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't get to... Jack is one of the members of the board, and I think he misunderstood, or I didn't make myself clear or something. I was not saying yesterday that the board controlled Holden Village. If I did seem to say that, I repent. Or that the board did until recently control Holden Village. I was raising the question of who ought to control Holden Village. And if I don't think, I mean, the question of who controls can never be discerned from looking at organizational charts. And in fact, the whole process of group decision is very complex. And I want to just spend a couple of minutes on this business of group decision, partly because, as Julie knows, I was worrying about it a lot at the beginning of the week and working out some complex examples. But I want to make some what I think are obvious points. And if you start to argue about them, I'll be bothered, because it seems to me they're obvious. I wrote them on the board. The first one is that groups don't have motives. And, whenever we disagree with the decision, we ask, well, gee, I wonder why she did that, or he did that, or they did that. And then we start looking for motives, purposes, reasons, visions, goals. You know, what was in the back of their mind? Well, now what I'm asserting is that boards, committees, groups, collectives don't have reasons, purposes, visions, motives. Only individuals do. And you got to recognize that very clearly. The fact that a board voted in a particular way on something doesn't tell you anything about the motives, and if you start inquiring about them, if there are 12 people on the board, you're inquiring about 12 different sets of motives. Now, the next point is that motives are not observable, at least by people on the outside. And, of course, we all know that. So what we do is we infer them from behavior, but we often don't infer them correctly. Secondly, they're not distinct. Now, when I say they're not observable, I think we can observe our own motives to some extent, but only to some extent. Because I don't think motives are distinct entities. I have a motive sitting right here, and that motive rises up and bingo, you know, I hit you in the nose. It's all much more mushy than that and complex. And so if they're not distinct, we don't even observe our own motives very clearly. And then the third thing is that motives are morally relevant. That is to say, when you want to know, should you condemn a person for an action? Well, if you find out he had a good motive, then you say, well, okay, I understand, and you excuse, and you don't condemn. If a person does a good thing, but does it for what you think is a bad motive, you condemn him. In fact, the essence of condemnation is the evaluation of motives. And then you think about it. When you condemn or applaud, you're condemning or applauding motives, reasons, you know, what's driving. But that's what we think as morally relevant. Now, the reason I mention that is because that enormously complicates the picture. If it is the motives that make someone's action good or bad, and we can't observe other people's motives, we are in a tricky game. Because we are condemning and applauding all the time. So what does this say? It says, be very careful, particularly about condemning or applauding the decisions of boards, of groups. And then I want to add, when I got in the village this week, there were some people saying they wanted to confront the board and find out why they made the decision they did. That's a nonsensical request. And then we had a Monday night session where I think some people were trying to find out why the board did certain things and what the board's vision was. And the board has no vision. The board had no motives. Individuals have, and people aren't quite sure what these things are, and they're hesitant about it. You know, you vote on something suspecting this, fairly sure of this, hoping this, praying for that, and now it all comes together in a board. And here's the further complicating thing, that if you knew the motives of every individual on a 12-woman board, you still wouldn't know what the outcome would be, necessarily. I just put an example up here. Suppose you've got five people, they have to make a decision whether we should run, pass, or kick. All right? And you say, well, what should we do, run, pass, or kick? Five people, they're all equal value. And you say, all right, write down a little slip of paper, your preference, what you'd first like to do, second choice, and your third choice. And here come the votes in. Abe, run first, pass second, kick third. Ben the same way. Now you look at that and tell me, what's the group's will? You can discern something from that if you want to do. In fact, I submitted it to Julie to see what she would say, and as I hope, she came up with pass as the will of the group on the grounds that only one person put pass in third place. That's a kind of a, you know, minimize the dissatisfaction approach, which is often the way a group works. You know? But there are other ways it could work. Notice Abe and Ben are the only men. And suppose that Eb stands for Evelyn. And we divide along. Suppose everybody has a sense that it's time to end this male dominance. Well, then what are we likely to do? We're going to kick. Or, on the other hand, Abe and Ben could be regarded as, of course, authorities in sports matters. Or they could have caucused beforehand. Or suppose we say, well, look, let's go back. Let's just have a simple vote. We'll vote them off pairwise. Now, if you look at that, you will discover that if you vote them off pairwise, any one of them can win, depending on which two you bring to a vote first. Suppose we vote first on run versus pass. Which one will be eliminated? Run versus pass. You see, run will eliminate pass because three people prefer run to pass. All right, so then we put run against kick, and what will win? Three people prefer kick to run, and we will kick. But if we had started off by voting run against kick, what would happen? Kick would eliminate run. And then, what happens? What happens when you put run against pass? Run eliminates pass, so we'll run. Now, so you check it out if you want to, that the order in which you bring things to a vote often determines the outcome of the group. And what determines the order in which you bring things to a vote? Sometimes the fact that nobody notices that it makes any difference. But sometimes there's one person in the group who realizes it does make a difference, and he gets together in caucuses and just, you know, determines the agenda. Well, all right. Now, what does this have to do with community? Well, one thing it has to do with community is that group decisions are always going to be a part of a community. And I'm not saying that they're hostile to community. I think community, though, is an interpersonal thing. And what I'm talking about here is impersonality. Now, I think we can get closer to a community decision the longer we talk and discuss, and the more the five people here are able to enter into one another's individual motives, aspirations, visions, and so on. But the larger that number gets, the more difficult that becomes. And sometimes you have to act. It's fourth down. And we're gonna adjourn for a week and decide what to do. Sarah?
Yeah. It seems to me, though, Paul, that you're somewhat blurring, at least for me, motivations, which are indeed personal, and visions. And I do think that oftentimes boards, hopefully, have some, at least consensus about vision. At least some of the boards that I'm on, we do spend time coming to a consensus about what it is we're about and why we're there. And then sometimes that is our deals with our agendas, what those priorities are. I think that's there. And I think it is a group thing. It doesn't mean the functional manners of how you're going to do things is not always personal, but it is informed by a consensus of what the group thinks is important, at least on the board I'm on, and how it really works that way. It's not to say that we don't vote for things out of our own personal things that we think something ought to be pushed more than the other. But we have set down what we think are the important ideas or visions for the particular thing we're all interested in and why we're all serving on the board we're serving on. I think vision is possible in a group.
Okay, I didn't say vision is impossible in a group.
But you were mixing them, I felt.
I'm saying I'm not going to argue the point. You heard what Sarah said. She thinks boards can have visions. I think boards cannot have visions. You think about it. And maybe the way to avoid a, you say, well, gee whiz, who's right? You at least recognize that maybe boards can have visions, but can the members of a board always be sure that they have the same vision even when they've written it all out? Or is it possible to write out in 500 words a complete, precise statement of your vision and then discover that there's disagreement yet because, in fact, you're interpreting those words differently? Maybe it's a dogma that I use or that only individuals have these things, but it's at least, you would agree, Sarah, that it's complex.
Indeed.
Yeah, I have a great deal of trouble with students who come in and complain about why the university is doing what it's doing. And I try to get them to see that the university never does anything. The university has no reasons. And you know, that's an important lever of change. If you want to make the university different, you have to know who is interested in doing what and why. Lots of things, you can get a lot of things changed when you discover in whose interest it is to make that particular decision. And then you go to that person's office and make it in his interest to do something else. What I wanted to spend time on today was basically the problem of diversity in community. And, diversity, that captures it. I wonder, well, let me tell you the kinds of diversity, the forms of diversity that have impressed me in my reading and my experience in talking to people about community. First of all, diversity of wealth. I'm thinking of wealth in the usual sense of the term. This is an enemy of community. Maybe only because of the great importance that wealth has maliciously assumed in our society. But someone who does have a lot of wealth has status and power, and even potential power. And even if he denies it, he will use that power. He still has it potentially. For example, the fact that I have more income than the other members of Capitol Hill Methodist Church is bound to have some impact on the way they treat me. Because I make large contributions to that congregation. And sure, I've never said, if you don't do what I say, I will withdraw my contributions. But isn't that bound to be, isn't the person who contributes $100,000 to the orphanage may have only one vote, but and You know, and also, it's just wealth has social significance. All right, this is a real problem. But there's another form of wealth that I think I worry about more. The Economist calls it human wealth or human capital. People have different skills and abilities. And even the skill, the ability to process goods into satisfactions. Some people, for example, can't have much fun unless they have an awful lot of money because they're not very good at transforming simple things like sunsets and evening breezes into satisfactions. Or some people love to read. And they read omnivorously, and they can live very cheaply because they have that piece of human capital which enables them to turn the whole cotton-picking library into something more valuable than all the movie theaters in town, which you might notice are much more expensive. Now these are important differences among people. And can you see what... So you go into a community, you say, well, let's all live at the same level. You can't do it. If everybody has the same income, everybody's not going to have the same amount of satisfaction. Far, far from it. You know, and that's... that gets you into a bind. I'm going to come back in a moment to the question of what do we mean by equality? And I like to throw this at my students. What would it mean if everything were equally distributed? What would count as an equal distribution? And just watch people tie themselves in knots, trying to achieve justice, in some kind of ideal world. Another, not often discussed, but I think terribly important difference among people is difference in time horizon. It is rate at which they discount future events. Some people are radically present-oriented. Things that are a month away are... cross that bridge when I get there. Things that are 5 years away don't even exist. On the other hand, there are people who, at the age of 21, will not take a job unless it provides adequate retirement benefits. There's scads of empirical evidence that this is a difference between people. Moreover, this difference is highly correlated with social and economic class. In other words, if you are of an upper middle income socioeconomic class, the chance is very good that you have a low rate of time discount. That is, you count future events as very important. You have a long time horizon. And if you are very poor, chances are good that you are radically present oriented. Now, which is cause and which is effect? You see, if you're always living from hand to mouth because you haven't got anything, you haven't got time to look at the future. On the other hand, if you are radically present oriented, you're going to be poor because you're never going to invest. You're not going to invest in school. You're going to drop out of school. Kids drop out of school because they're radically present-oriented. In fact, the real danger is that teenagers tend to be radically present-oriented somehow by the nature of the beast or by the nature of the socialization process in our society. And therefore, they tend to make often very, very bad decisions. For example, I wonder whether teenagers sopping up beer at 8 o'clock in the evening has an adequately low rate of time discount to think about 1 o'clock when he's going to be driving that car home again. This can make enormous differences in a city where people pitch stuff. That time horizon business is also correlated, very strongly correlated, with your ability to empathize with other people, with larger groups of people. And it's related to what I call aesthetic space. You say, how can people live like that? You say, good. How can they live in that pit? And you look around their house, their beer cans, just crap. And the answer is they're not looking at that space. You might get inside and find it's just as neat as a pin. On the other hand, you might find it's a pit inside too. But they don't care. They wiggle their way through that space. Now you're going to put all these people together, and I'm coming back to the city, but this would apply in any community. You put all these people together inside one rope. One group is going to say start talking about the slobs. And the other group is going to start to talk about the people who never have any fun, the legalists. Well, I think it really helps to recognize the importance of something that is, as ethically neutral as time horizon or rate of time preference. And I can make a good case for both. A person with a low rate of time preference has the Protestant ethic. He is sober, industrious, thrifty. He's a doer of good. He's one of those solid types. And you say, that's what we need more of in this world, right? Indeed. He's responsible. He's a person who really cares for the suffering of the hungry in India because he has long time horizon. He can think about his great-grandchildren, and so he's environmentally conscious. You see, well, that's the kind we want, but let's be careful. Whew, what a world. If they were all like that. What about celebration of the moment, living in the present? Do we want to go through life always getting ready, never enjoying because we're always laying aside? The story of the ant and the grasshopper. When I was young, I knew the ant was right. And when I got older, I'm not so sure. The grasshopper may have had the right idea. There's another way to tell the story. When the winter, just before winter came, the ant got stepped on. So did the grasshopper. So. Another difference that has bothered me in my working with community at work and residence and church and everything else is there are thinkers and there are feelers. There are people who like theory and there are people who swear by experience. I don't think there's a real conflict here. But in order to make that point, I have to ask people to sit down and theorize with me. I have to insist they get them my turn. I am classified as a thinker, as a theorist, as an arid intellectual, a professor, an academician, someone who needs to meet a payroll. There are all kinds of ways you're going to encounter this. I was talking yesterday about, or no, it was Wednesday or Thursday, whenever again, about affects and effects and about the function of talk and conversation. This enters in here too. You see, because of my preference and the preference of other people too, for getting the thing clear, we tend to be critical. In our conversation, when we sit around, what shall we do? There's some people say, let's just get all our feelings out. And we sort of, let's take off our shoes. That's sort of you can spot the feeders. They begin by unlacing their shoes before the meeting. And the thinkers are sitting there with pens and they're taking notes. They're trying to get arguments done. I have fought this battle. The reason I think there is no real conflict, although I can't prove it to people who claim that I'm one-sided, I think I'm really a happy blend of thinker and thinker. Well, the reason that I think there is no ultimate conflict is because I've been fighting in education this battle. For 8 years, I've been fighting it within myself and in my classes and with my colleagues, and I have been attacked from both sides. That doesn't mean I'm right. That means I'm wrong all the time. But I think that I've been battling the rigorists in education. There are a lot of people who say, we've got to get back to basics, to rigor, intellectual rigor. We've had enough of this, group bull session stuff. Everybody gets together and feels good. Every classroom is an encounter therapy session. I can sympathize with much of that. I don't think people learn by raising ignorance to a sufficiently high power when nobody knows anything, but let's pool it all. However, what the rigorists, if you look at the rigorists, they haven't been teaching a blasted thing. The rigorists have been forcing people to memorize answers to questions that people aren't asking. And there's nothing rigorous about their education. In the economics department, I've been blasted by colleagues who, now not anymore, I'm very happy at the University of Washington because I think the people there understand that. If they don't, if they haven't thought about it, they keep their noses out of it. But the last university which I taught, there were a whole bunch of people who didn't know beans about teaching, who wouldn't recognize a student if they fell over one. A student was some kind of abstraction into which you pummeled mathematical equations. They terrorized students. And if the students could regurgitate the things that they had accidentally internalized during a terrorization process, they passed. And the fact that they couldn't apply it at all, this isn't education. What we need to do is to be attentive to feelings all the time and to recognize that what a person is able to think is going to depend upon the way she is in contact with her feelings. And that a teacher who is not in contact with her feelings is going to be an autocrat and inattentive and misinterpreting and answering questions that weren't answered. You've seen teachers who they answer before you get the question out and they didn't catch the question. They're so defending themselves, they're so unsure of themselves. I really hope I'm not making this clear. Well, see, that just proves that I'm sufficiently muddy to be a feeler. I really think that we ought to explore this hypothesis in the continuing battle between the thinkers and the feelers, that the solution, the common ground, lies in greater attentiveness. Attentiveness to everything, to what I'm feeling inside me right now. A little anxiety, little silliness, to what you are feeling, as nearly as I can infer it, and I must be supportive of you in your dealings with one another and with me. Attentiveness to this, and then attentiveness to what we say. How little listening there is compared to the amount of talking that goes on in our society. Watch at the next party at your house how people are waiting, just waiting for him to finish so I can start. And in our classes it's the same way. We're not, in part in class it's because people are frightened. They're not paying attention to what I am saying because they are worried about what I might do to them. And they're trying to psych me out. But if I'm afraid of them, and teachers very often are afraid of students, and if I'm not, I don't acknowledge, if I'm not attentive to that fear, I'm going to get more and more out of touch with what I'm saying. Well, that's obviously a tough assignment for a community, but I think that it's one of the key things. The week I spent, I mentioned it last night in Vespers, the week I spent in that Quaker community at the end of June really brought it home to me. It was a device. I'm going to use it now in teaching. Several times during heated discussions, the chairman said, operating out of the Quaker tradition, would you stop, please? I would like everyone to to stop now, and for 2 minutes we'll have silence. And everyone will think about what was just said. Now you might say, would you repeat that? Or sometimes there'll be two positions that are particularly clear and seemingly contradictory, and you get repetition of those. And then everyone sits in silence. And I was very anxious when I went to Pendle Hill about having to worship in silence, because my mind is like a monkey. You know, I was thinking about my stomach growling was before breakfast. And I was not still uptight about it, but oh boy, the pregnancy of silence among people who can live with it. Maybe we ought to learn a little better how to live it. Question is, how long could that silence endure? Do you get, isn't he prepared? You're at a party where nobody's talking and you just feel terrible. Sarah?
Isn't it one of the things they do in the Church of the Savior and their group meetings is in between each speaker when they're having a committee meeting or something like that, that there always is some silence before there's response to the next speaker. I don't know how long it is, but there's never that you talk and all of a sudden then I'm breaking in. There's sort of a rule. I don't quite know how it's enforced or if it is, but that there's always some pregnant silence between each person. Of course, when I find that in committee meetings, and there we are just charging in most of the time to get it out what we have to say without listening to what anybody else has to say. And of course, decisions are made because a lot of us don't listen a lot of times too. So I think that silence thing, but it's awfully scary for those of us that are not used to it.
I would like a couple of tables in the back of the dining room reserved for people who would like not to talk or eat.
Yeah, that sounds sensible, doesn't it? That I like to talk. For me and for lots of people, eating is a time for animated conversation. But for some people, yeah, right, sometimes you don't, and some people want the time of eating in silence. There's a good tradition. Why don't you suggest that to
everybody?
Be easy. Well, you know, be easy to, let's just try it today.
There is, I found a suggestion box. Does everybody know where it is? Something I wanted to offer yesterday too, and I thought, you know, I should mention this, that there is one in the high house. It's not too obvious, but after I found out where it is, they put paper and a pencil there.
I think it's usually better to find out the person who is in charge of the area and go to that person and explain. You know, it's very hard to.
They say in worship too that our worship that all of us have the organ. You know, you can't. There's no time for a pause. The organ will quickly fill in any space. If there's communion, there must be some background music or some hymn. There could not be a period in which there's just dead silence, you know. And that really it would give people chances to think even during the service. Maybe this is what the bakers are up to, I don't know.
Doris?
You used to be able to go into libraries and everything would be silent. But now CLC is planning a new library and the students are insisting that they have some music going.
Oh, no. Music?
They cannot study in pure silence anymore. Now there's something wrong.
Yeah, well, let's. I think you gotta be careful. There may be two issues going here. Maybe, you know, one can meditate if he's used to it. Some people can meditate better with background noise. In fact, one of the techniques of meditation is sometimes recommended is that you have some background noise to screen out distractions, which Muzak might be. So there are two things going on here. The tendency of our society to fill every space with noise, diversion, which is an enemy of contemplation and attentiveness. And then I think the broader question of whether we are contemplative and passive and attentive often enough. And one can indeed, I think, be attentive in a very noisy place. I find that downtown, or riding a bus, I find I can contemplate. It's a very noisy place. But all those noises just pass me by for me, again, the organ playing is good. It drowns out things that are likely to buzz in and distract me, but not for everyone. All right, now, let me raise the question of what equality means. I'm not going to go around the room and ask you, but I'm not suggesting, no, I don't think that community presupposes equality. I do think community presupposes equity, justice in the distribution of goodies. But what is justice in the distribution of goodies? I'm not asking you what could we create it. You might have an idea, a definition of justice, but you might say, nonetheless, in this sinful world, it's impossible to achieve it. But I suggest that you probably don't even have a clear notion in your head of what your ideal of justice is. If you're at all like students I've been teaching for many years, who, when I ask them to spell out their idea of justice, begin to contradict themselves after a while, showing that they haven't really thought it through. And I don't know either. We have tended in recent years in our society, in government programs, to redistribute in the interest of justice, to focus on money income. But I think that what people really want more than money income is status and power. Status and or power. Once you get beyond a certain minimum level, you've got enough food and you've got a roof to keep the rain off, what do you want more money for? What do you want to buy? You want to buy a wall-to-wall carpeting. Why? So when your friends walk in, they'll say, what a lovely living room. What's the significance of a high salary? Clearly, it'll buy you. It buys you power over others. To some extent, if you have a lot of money, people come to you and treat you nicely. A lot of public officials have power because they have control over a spigot. They don't take any of that money and put it directly in their pockets. What they put in their pockets is the satisfaction that comes from being the person in control of the spigot, which is what a lot of people want money for. And in part, a person's salary is significant because it tells others how important society thinks he is. So why is it, Milton Friedman points out, why is it that if he were to win the Irish sweepstakes, all his colleagues would clap him on the back, be genuinely glad for him, but if he got $1,000 raise that they did not get, they'd badmouth him? Because those those salaries are supposed to be indications of social worth. So I'm suggesting is that it is it, what is it that the poor don't have that makes them so frustrated and angry? Is it maybe status? Power? I don't know. Doris?
Well, a lot of times it's because they can't pay the taxes on the home that they bought because of the inflation.
Who can't?
I mean, you know, older people. I mean, that's when the money becomes significant because you get scared that somebody else is going to have to pay your way and you're going to be dependent on other people. And people who have really been frugal and saved money now are finding they have to depend entirely upon charity because they miscalculated how much they really needed to take care of themselves in old age.
Okay, I missed a connection there somewhere, but
well, you were asking why, you know, what is enough, and what was the question? And I think it depends on where you are in the age level, for instance, and also the condition of the country at the time. You know, can you depend on things being stable, or are things going to be inflated constantly? Just how much are you going to be able to save? How much you will need?
Yeah.
Is an unknown quantity.
Well, okay. What I hear you saying now in relation to my thing is you want power over your future. And money is important as giving you assured power over your future.
That's right.
Yeah, right. And of course that, you know, and that's one of the reasons that the demand for money is insatiable, I think. That's one of the reasons why people never have enough. Once you get into the business of saving, consciously saving, you can never get enough. Because, you know, there's always a contingency. That, you know, but what if this, you know, now we've got these medicals, that what if I need time on the kidney machine? And
I was thinking that part of what Christ was saying in Matthew 6 about, you know, not thinking about tomorrow because tomorrow takes care of itself is just that one of the problems we have with listening is we're so preoccupied all the time with our concerns and our, you know, whether we are going to be respected tomorrow, whether we're going to, and so most of the time we're with another person, we're preoccupied with our own concerns. It's kind of tough to do that.
All right. Now let me do FG's general just reflection on equality, money, what people are after. In a community, now, I've been struck with the fact, I've thought a lot as an economist and as someone who comes to Holden Village a lot and observes and someone interested in community and social relationships and work and sociology and psychology of work, I've been struck with a kind of weird way we do things. Work or function, the tasks one performs, in our society have a lot to do with everything that one is. You know, if you have a highly prestigious job, chances are you make a lot of money. let's just focus on Holden Village. There are skills to begin with. You know, there's an ability factor. You can't, let's say, somebody who right, somebody who's 4'2" and weighs 62 pounds probably shouldn't be assigned to split logs. Okay? But then, there's intrinsic satisfaction of the job, there is social status of the job, and then there's external compensation. And I often wondered whether we can't mix these more creatively than we've been doing. Let me be specific. It bothers me at Holden Village that the faculty doesn't have to work, do physical work. Because I've long sense, and I'm sure anybody who's spent time up here senses it, that the faculty they've got the best of it. They can bring their families up with no squawking. Sure, staff can, volunteer staff can bring their families too, but they better not have too many kids. And I suspect over the long haul, the chances of getting in here if they got kids are a little worse than if they haven't. Because, you know, it's more weight for the village to carry. And then, too, the husband and wife will both be expected to work. But a faculty person can come up here with spouse and five kids and give a few lectures. And, you know, now we come to the next thing, too. Which is more prestigious? Being able to sit here at 9:15 in the morning, commanding an audience, which do you think has more intrinsic satisfaction? Doing this or splitting wood? Well, now, why should I get originally, fortunately they dropped this when it turned out faculty were eager to come, why should I get my way paid? That's what they used to do. Faculty would get round trip compensation. And a nice chalet to house my family. And my wife and kids don't have to work. And the prestige. and I don't have to do any physical work either. I don't know where this leads. There are real problems involved with this. There are questions of supply and demand. You know, it might be that good faculty are very scarce, and in order to obtain them, it is necessary to offer them all these goodies. Well, but you see, sometimes we can look at the supply and demand situation and say, that ain't so. Like right now, in college teaching bothers me. College professors are very well paid, have very cushy jobs, get a lot of prestige, a lot of internal satisfaction. I would like to see faculty salaries substantially reduced in universities. And we can do it. And we can do it without diminishing the quality, because there are lots of people queued up who are better quality than the people who already have our snouts in the trough. Now, why don't we do this? I wish we'd play more with this. Anyway, Doris?
Well, I know Carol Henry used to say that it's the faculty who supports the village money-wise as well as talent-wise. Most of them pay the same fees as guests would pay. Of course, it's a donation, so it's tax deductible. But as far as the money is concerned, that's all as far as I can see.
Well, okay, I still would like to see a work requirement faculty. If a faculty member volunteers to do something, he gets all kinds of strokes. He says, I really, it's so nice of you to help out. And you quit early.
I really don't think that that's a big misreading. I think your example is an excellent one in terms of the question of status in our society. And it is very obvious in our society that those jobs that require lots of schooling and usually also pay quite well are also high status. That's just, and high status somehow, that's more valuable. I mean, I don't understand it. I'm just saying that is the case. And Holden represents the larger society in many ways, and its male dominance, it certainly represents the other society too. I mean, Holden is not a little paradise. I think that especially from several years ago, or, you know, was just automatically assumed kind of thing. And I don't think anybody's really thought about it very much, maybe. Because it does seem, I think that it seems extremely odd.
I don't think the faculty should
have these
be made
status.
But would.
Why?
I mean, why?
Well, I don't think it should be made to split wood, but I think that every faculty member should be required to do certain amount of work per day. Physical work. Work contributing to the maintenance of the village. Make beds, do dishes, work in the kitchen.
There might be less room for someone else to come in and do this house.
Now, she's pointing out another factor here, that this is also opportunity. I did not begin working at the village when I came up here because I felt that it was important to make the life of the community. I just felt, I began working on dish team because there were so blasted many faculty up here that I never had enough to do. You know, you get in, we would sit here on Sunday afternoon faculty meetings and fight for an hour. And, you know, being kind of Protestant ethic person, I would like to earn my way. And I just felt I didn't have enough work to do. Now, there people do want to do some work. And, you know, guests have experienced this, that when you can find do something, you really feel you belong. There is a sense of participation. So, but man, I'd like to see us play more with this. The socially cohesive power of work and the community creating aspects of work. In my own job outside, I fuss around as much as I can with secretaries, custodians, and the way we work together, and I try to do secretaries' tasks a little bit, and try to let them do some of my tasks and split things up with the custodians, because I like the sense of fellowship that it creates. And
well, for that reason, it's all right.
Yeah. Okay, but.
Yeah. I don't think that a fellow who has expertise and artistry in certain areas should be made to do something in another area simply because that's the rule. If there is a reason for it other than that, if there is a reason that it brings about a better feeling of belonging, that's a different situation, it seems to me.
Can I say something?
Okay. Yeah, and then this gentleman. Go ahead.
Like, I agree with you. You know, like, I really think our lives are the price to be paid. You know, and everybody, like in their lives, they decide what they want to be. And for the most part, people in prestigious position have paid a price to get there. You know, like I split wood, and I never really paid a price to get into a real prestigious position as far as teaching or anything, because I enjoy manual labor more than I enjoy teaching. So as a result, I feel the people who have paid the price, who have gone through the route and gone to school in order not to work manually, but yet to be in a prestigious position, have paid the price to get what they want. You know, and should be allowed to function in that capacity. And the people who haven't been willing to pay that kind of a price, you know, and who, in a sense, they're saying they like where they're at, you know, should be able to stay where they're at and do what they're doing. I think it's the principle of just a price being paid. You
know. Okay.
Is that clear?
Yeah, it may be debatable because it depends on whether schooling is a price or whether people enjoy schooling.
Right, I was going to say, I think
generally the people that, how many people here have degrees beyond a bachelor's degree? Okay, and I would just like to check, is there anybody, any of those people who have their hands up who didn't enjoy school?
I'm not saying that school's not enjoyable.
Yeah, but it's particularly enjoyable for people who get advanced degrees because they're adept at that sort of thing. They say they paid a price to get there.
Well, in a sense, it is a price. I didn't mean the connotation to be, you know, bad connotations, but there's a lot of work that these people have gone to get that degree, and whether they enjoyed it or whether they didn't enjoy it, it's still a price.
Okay.
The problem I would see, though, if every faculty member began to be as interested in the manual side, it could conceivably get reduced the opportunities that these students have, or those who are coming here for a work experience. You know, everybody's doing so much that, you know, we don't really need that, and the opportunities could be greater. It's the same problem we have of a man works an 8-hour shift, but because he's good at other things, he starts moonlighting. He does 3-4 hours after, and there's some real dangers, I see, if you push it too far. Some, but you have to have some organization in that. I hate to see all the young people go because the faculty come in here with their sleeves rolled up and there's nothing left.
Okay, let's see. 1, 2, and 3, all right? As I saw the hands, go ahead.
I like what you said about sharing with secretaries and custodians and letting them do some of yours, but I guess I too feel that it's somewhat condescending to say that faculty should do manual work, but not the reverse, to say those who are doing manual work should also share in some of the verbal stuff. If we're going to really have community that way and do each other's tasks or help in them, then those who are doing manual work should have an opportunity to also contribute.
Yeah, but you got to be careful because the ability does enter in here. Doctor, I think
Does it the other way.
That's true. But still, a physician is capable of doing almost all of the things, including emptying the waste baskets. But the person who empties the waste baskets probably isn't capable of taking out an appendix. And so there is a... It is the fact that some of these abilities are scarce that's responsible for their prestige and high. You're right. Your point about condescension is a good one. Okay, Mark.
From the standpoint of a worker, I think it would be wonderful if the faculty did some things for this, because that would be another opportunity for us to talk to them, to challenge them, question all kinds of things with them. And that's how we'd really get to know them, much more than through sessions like this. I think it's good for the sessions. That would be a great opportunity for getting to know them. I also don't think it would reduce the staff here, because right now some people don't work, you know, over 4 or 5 hours a day the way it is, staff, and others work a little more. So, if the faculty helped out, it would just mean that someone has to work 6 hours and they have to work 4.
That would
be kind of nice.
Some of the things that aren't done will get done.
There's always plenty of work.
Sure. Ken?
I guess my feeling, though anti the compulsion type of thing, in the field of education, we're often guilty of talking a lot about individual differences and then saying, but everybody should do this or everybody should take this course and so on. And I guess along that line, you know, those who wish on the faculty to do that type of work, I think it's great. And following your idea, I think there is a lot of talent and knowledge in the crew or staff or whatever you call them that could be shared with us from those who are interested in doing so, which I don't think we've tapped. But I'd like to see the voluntary aspect work both ways.
Okay. Elmer, I think Elmer was next, and then. Okay.
Yeah. A couple of reactions. Well, one is, I think, well, first of all, finding better ways of interacting as a goal. That, I think, is neat in what you're saying. I think it would be better to start at giving up the chalet and living in the lodges with the other people would be a lot better way of achieving what you're after, it seems to me, than the work process. Although I think if that would lead to better exchange, I'm not too sure it does. That's a theory that ought to be tested. The test of it here is the eating procedures. where we don't do what you're asking for, and it's already available to us. We click off into our own groups, staff neatly sitting mostly with staff, faculty often sitting with itself, but it's already here. We don't use what's already there. I like that. There's two things we can do right away. Give up the chalets and start using the meal times. Lots better for the kind of exchange that's going on. Third is, I wonder if this business of physical is the right word. I did an hour counseling already today. Yesterday, I had to get about six names to send stuff to people who were here who want stuff for me going on. Physical energy was expanded like mad already today. And there's an implication that somebody isn't using physical energy by not doing physical labor, pounding, you know. I use more energy counseling than I do in pounding a piece of wood. I guess I'm not a little satisfied with the implication that there's manual or physical. My manual stuff is going on in me like mad in a session. I don't know if that's helpful.
Well, I think this is the guess contributing to the workflow. Yeah, I've been picking flowers and I'd like to do some more things. I was in the laundry room, I loved it in there. I would have loved, you know. And I know you can't have guests coming in for 10 minutes here, but I think there should be some area where guests can contribute so that they know they've done something while they were here.
You know, another thing too has been, I don't know, I can't speak for anyone else, but my perception of the way that staff has been developed here was that they were workers, but staff were invited to participate in the whole life of the village, the worship, the sessions. And staff have been in forums and such, and this morning we had an eye-opener done by a staff member. I mean, this maybe, you could say this maybe could be done more, but, you know, it has been done. And if the idea that the staff themselves are volunteers, you know, I mean, they're coming here to volunteer their time, so it isn't, you know, it's not like it's not an exchange where they're the workers and everyone else isn't doing anything, you know. Maybe it comes from that side, too. The staff is already involved in the life of the village, and the more that they are, the more chance there is for it to go the other way. If I get to know someone really well, and he says, well, gee, I'd like to come out and split wood with you, well, sure, come along and join, you know, or whatever. It happens. I mean, the line can be crossed from either side.